internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 634. I'm one of your hosts, Skyler Vicroy, and joining me today, as ever, is Jim McDowell. Jim, how's it going, man?
It's going pretty good. We are now nearing what I think is going to be end of at least quarantine or work from home for me. We've been given our order.
Well, I got extended.
Did you? No, we are supposed to go back on the 4th of May, but we're supposed to be staggered, which means, from what I understand, like half of our group will work 1 week from home and one group will be in the office, or like an A team, B team kind of thing. Gotcha. And we'll see how that rolls and plays out. But hey, who knows when it's all going to be over? Just the lack of motorsports right now is starting to really drive me crazy.
I hear that. I mean, I've been watching those, the sim racing, and I was watching the iRacing from the IndyCar did it, and was entertained, and I kind of just looked at myself like, this is where we're at now. Like, I didn't just kind of watch it, like, you know, like, oh, this is interesting. I, like, watched it, like, sat down, cleared my schedule, because that was, like, some kind of live racing that I could actually watch. So, I don't know. I guess you take what you can get.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a good server once told me any port in a storm, so.
True. All right, so now, as many have come to notice in recent weeks, and it's a call back to earlier shows, but we always have to start the show off right, Jim. So let's get it going.
Go for it.
All right, so let's see. We cracked open from, it's called Marine Dream. It's a hazy India pale ale, which, of course, you know, I'm on my hazy kick. This is from the Coronado Brewing Company. They're down south. And let's take a sip of this bad boy and see how it is. Hey, that's a pretty good one there. A little light on the haze, but not so strong on the IPA. So a nice blend. Very summer-ish beer. Which is perfect because it was like 85 degrees here today. We've apparently already made it to summer. We got the fans and the AC in the house running. I know some of you are probably like, 80 degrees, that's nothing. It's the same thing. It's 100 degrees in Texas or it's negative 100 in Canada. Take your pick. I'm just hot. So, oh, but I tell you, Jim, I've been finding other ways to keep myself entertained lately, that's for sure. Got into, like I said, mentioned, I got my mountain biking, but then I went and got a gravel bike now. So,
oh, really?
Putting in some serious miles. I have a buddy of mine, he picked one up as well. He's a marathoner, and he's going to drag me out to Yellowstone towards October, maybe. We may have to do it sooner. It does get pretty cold over in that part sooner than out here. Do a 153-mile ride and kind of do like this Yellowstone loop. So I've got my work cut out for me, that's for sure.
So exactly what is a gravel bike? Help me out.
So a gravel bike, think of a road bike. It's a little bit beefier.
Okay.
It's got bigger tires. It's got disc brakes. It's got, still has drop bars, but the drop bars are set up a little bit higher. They're not down. You're not in that completely hunched over position. My bike has a little shock in the stem, so just between the frame and the handlebar, or not the stem, but in the actual, the top of the fork. Oh, come on, brain. Anyway, doesn't matter.
I was going to say the triple trees, but yeah, probably not right.
No, not the triple trees. Downhill bike on the crown, yeah, maybe. But the no, it's kind of right there, rides above the frame, in between the stem and the frame itself. It's on the top of the fork, essentially. It's a little shock. It's called the feet shock. And the frame has some built-in points into it as well that have a little bit more flex for going over gravel. And so it's kind of this new thing where it's almost how mountain bikes were back in the day before suspension, essentially, where they were real rigid, light, meant to pedal uphill really fast. Downhill, not so much. But they're also called adventure bikes because there's all these little mounts that can put like bags and compartments and things like that on and just tour with the bike. And so they're meant for putting a ton of miles on, and which is perfect because I don't ride road bikes out here anymore. Had a couple buddies get squished by some cars. And so I was like, okay, I'm not doing that anymore. But I've got a lot of gravel roads out here that I have access to from trails, which is nice. So I barely spend any time on the road, and I've got a whole bunch of buddies out here that ride as well. So it's a disease, this cycling stuff. You get one and it just festers, and you have like three, and then your wife gets one and she has two, and then all of a sudden you look at your garage and there's more money in bikes than the cars that you own.
Sounds like me and chainsaws.
Oh, I have to hear about this. Let's talk about chainsaw talk.
So, you know, you can't have just one chainsaw, right? So I've got a nice steel 20-inch bar, you know, 30 cc's. Got another Husqvarna on a 16-inch bar for smaller trees. Then I've got this nice pole saw still that you can extend out and cut down limbs that are high up from standing on the ground. And then let's see, what's the last one? Oh, it's a little electric one so that you can kind of lop off little limbs and do some touch-up work and really not have to strain yourself by using a handsaw.
Nice. Very nice. The only chance I ever had was a crappy electric Craftsman one that we bent working on a tree. So that was the extent of chainsaws that I've used.
Yeah, you know, everybody's got their thing they want to spend money on. So, but I love hearing two strokes, and the only way you can hear a two stroke nowadays is pretty much with a chainsaw. So,
yeah.
Gotta do it.
One day I will have, when I have actually something, well, things to cut down, maybe when I get a little bit of land or something. That's what I'm giving. There's really no point of me having one now, other than the fact just to have one. All right, so a bit of news. Oh, yeah, we're doing a motorcycle podcast, so let's get back to that. A bit of news. Rossi said he wants to try to decide his future by June. Sure. I don't know how realistic this is, because I think his whole thing going into the season was, at least from my perspective, is that he wanted to see if it was still fun, if he still wanted to do this. And obviously with the season being, you know, cut short, he would have had a good number of races under his belt by time June hit if we had started when we were supposed to start. But now we're going to, you know, he wants to make a decision. I don't know. I mean, I guess, does this excite you? Questions, Jim, anything?
At some point, Rossi's going to stop. It's just a matter of when he wants to stop. And if we really do get to Armageddon and there isn't a season, I don't think Rossi stops, because I think he wants to have one more go around, if you will. I can't see Rossi, with his personality, I can't see him just saying, I'm done, and not doing anything, and not having like a world, Rossi the final world tour kind of thing. I think he wants to go and pay homage to all the fans who've come to the races to see him one last time. I just can't see him doing it any other way.
Yeah, you've got a very good point. He does seem like he'd be very big on his farewell tour, going around and making sure that he got to do everything that he wanted to do one last time.
Yep. Yeah, it's going to be that. It's going to be the one last go, and that's what it's going to be. And you're not going to see, although I could kind of see Rossi doing one-offs on his team, sort of like how Roberts did when he quit, right? I mean, how many times did Roberts go back to Laguna Seca and ride, what was it, a Formula One bike, which essentially was a 500 Grand Prix bikes or whatever, at the AMA race in Laguna? You know, right. I think Roberts did that like three or four times after he retired. And, you know, I can see Rossi doing that. Like, well, you know, he's going to show up at Mugello and ride. And then, you know, and then next thing you know, it's going to be, Rossi's going to show up at San Marino on ride. And I can see him doing that for a couple of years. And it's that, hey, here's your one last chance to take the kids and let them see Rossi while Rossi was riding, you know, just so they have that moment in history in their head.
That's a good point. It would be interesting to see him kind of do that. But at the same time, you know, we've been seeing him set up his after racing life with his VR46 teams and his whole camp. I'm starting to think that eventually that's going to become so big and so time demanding that he just, racing is going to seem like a thing that's in his way of what he's actually wanting to do. He may actually have that shift in life where it's like, oh no, racing was a thing I did and I had to go put all this effort into, and I enjoy this aspect over here much more and watching other people. But then again, he's been in MotoGP how long and still hasn't quit, so that might be until you take it from my cold, dead fingers, I'm staying.
It could be. I do think that during all this quarantine, Rossi may realize that there is something more to life than just racing motorcycles. Not that he doesn't know that already, right? He's got a team, and he's got his clothing industry and all the other stuff that he's amassed. So he has all these other things, but he's going to realize it doesn't matter as much anymore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm a free man to do what it is that I want to do. And at some point, he's just going to say that's enough. And
true.
That's going to be that.
Definitely see that. Let's take a look here. All right, so Espeleta said he wants to get MotoGP back up and running in July. But, of course, this comes with a few assumptions that we kind of get things back up and running in the countries, and we make sure that it's safe for everyone. This may be at a limited capacity, like we spoke on last week, where, sure, we're back to racing, but only the teams are there and a few media personnel.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, this may also get dampened because, I hate to say it, folks, if we all go back and then we start getting sick again, they're going to redo this thing all over again. They're going to shut it down. And that's where, like you said, the Matt Oxley article, where it's doomsday, they have to kind of set a certain date in stone to be able to get in a season that's worth having. And then if they go, you know, we start testing the waters here again and find out it's just not feasible, well, I hate to say it, we're going to probably lose out on we're going to either have an extremely shortened season, or we're just going to have to hit the old reset button and come back next year, because they can't dangle these tracks forever because they have to make financial commitments. They have to get their sponsors, especially for tracks. A lot of them have government funding that has to be approved and used. There's so many moving parts to each of these events, and they have to lock down calendars. A lot of these events survive on just the pre-sale of tickets alone, just to get it up and running and get people in, and then make the money on the back end to cover the costs of the remaining of the race. There's so many parts, and if there's not enough adequate time, they really do have to make, just like any small business to mid-market to major business, they make a decision like, how bad is this going to affect the bottom line versus just turning the lights off and closing the doors and coming back when we've got a little bit more money.
Yep. I think the big thing is, I think everyone is tired of hearing ideas and concepts and, well, this is when we think we can go back. And now there sort of is a shift towards, hey, if we don't start by X, we really can't have a season. You know, I go back to Matt Oxley's article. Just the travel part of this is going to be an insanely difficult thing for the teams to do. You know, yep. Because as Matt Oxley puts out, they want to start in Austria. Okay, Austria's had about 600 deaths from the coronavirus. You contrast that with the next round, which would be in Great Britain at Silverstone. There's been 20,000 deaths. So I don't think Great Britain is going to be real apt to saying, hey, come bring your 3,500 band group of people across the English Channel and drop them off here and let's go race at Silverstone. And,
right.
You know, the other thing too is that it's not, I think what we kind of lose sight of in this is we think about the teams and how many people they have to bring, mechanics,
mm-hmm.
caterers, what, you know, support staff to make the motorcycles run. But what we aren't thinking about is, let's think about all of the other stuff that has to happen to have an actual motorcycle race. What about all the corner workers, track personnel, mm-hmm. all those mm-hmm. kind of people now are going to be, so we're going to have corner workers standing 6 feet apart from each other. Everybody's going to have a radio on. What happens if a rider goes down and they rush to it? Well, we're not going to be 6 feet apart. You know, that part I don't quite understand, nor do I get. But you got to have a helicopter pilot and the paramedics and all those other things. And, you know, so how dumb is motorsports going to look if you've got the air ambulance there at the racetrack for that weekend and it's needed somewhere else to take care of people who may potentially be having a drastic time dealing with the virus, right?
This is very true.
And I get that that happens on any possible weekend that MotoGP mm-hmm. is running, that there could be some massive car crash just on the open road that requires mm-hmm. the air ambulance and whatnot. And so I can see the argument from both sides, but it's one of these questions that I just think that we aren't necessarily thinking about. And, you know, even if they did say, okay, we're going to run in Austria, then we're going to go to Great Britain. Well, is Spain or France or Germany or Italy going to really want you to come back from a country that has over 20,000 deaths due to this virus? They're not going to really want you back. So are we going to have to quarantine everybody again?
Yeah.
I don't
know. And on top of that.
Yeah. And one more thing, and sorry, I didn't mean to cut you there.
No worries.
Is that if we do have them, they're going to have to all live together, be together, stay together, and be quarantined together.
Well, see, this is where I was going with it anyway. So okay. That worked out.
Because, I mean, there's now this talk. We've done this before. We did comparisons of other sports. So, you know, I like hockey, so here's a hockey analogy. They're looking at four cities to host teams and play out the regular season and then go into playoffs.
That's right. You were mentioning that.
Yeah, in Columbus, Ohio is one of the sites that has a lot of potential that it could be done. And it's because they've got some facilities, they got hotels nearby the arenas, they've got practice rinks. Everything's all close proximity of all that. Okay, so you're going to sit there and play it out, but you're going to play it out without anybody in the stands, without anybody around. And, you know, again, it comes down to you're going to create your own little mini city that's going to have to happen. And you have to do that with everybody in the Grand Prix paddock and do it at every event that you're going to go to. So that's like another logistical nightmare that, you know, you got to get to. And as Matt Oxley also points out, guess where all the bikes and equipment are all stored? They're in a warehouse in Madrid, Spain, on the outskirts of Madrid, which Spain is a very heavily ravaged country with the virus. So, you know, if we go back to racing and we get, you know, television crews and everybody in there and all that kind of jazz that's going to be there, you're going to see, it's going to be odd because you're going to see, I think, all the people and the mechanics and everybody running around with, you know, N95 masks, and everybody's going to be wiping everything down and sterilizing things. And is it really going to be racing? I don't know. I mean, it's going to be something, but it may not be the racing we're really accustomed to. And again, and, you know, not to keep ranting on, but the number of people, you know, there could be countries that are going to say, no, you can't bring 3,500 people to our country. So what do you do then? Do you say, nope, there's not going to be a Moto 2 and a Moto 3 round, and we're only going to have a Moto GP round?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so many different questions and so many different things that are going on. Who knows what's going to happen?
And, true. Man. So, and, you know, in the economic side of everything, too, it might be, you know, a positive from the downside of all this is that sponsors and teams kind of get to store their money for a year, and because we're definitely going to take an economic hit going through all of this, and sponsorship next year will be even harder. So if we got a few bucks put away, it might be beneficial. But let's move on, because I'm sure everybody by now is like, all right, enough of the bad news. Get back to the motorcycle talk, boys. All right, cool. Heard you loud and clear. So Lorenzo, as Jim has pointed out many times, he thinks he just, you know, skated out of Honda so he can get back on a Yamaha. There's more and more wildcard rounds he's talked about, or not he's talked about, but others have talked about him doing. And at this point, if you're doing 4 to 5 wildcard rounds, it's starting to look like you might be lining yourself up to make a comeback, depending on how that goes.
Mm-hmm. He's back on the bike that he wants, a Yamaha, right?
Yep.
So how would you like this for irony? Rossi starts his own team, and him and Lorenzo are on it.
Right. I wouldn't say it's not possible. It would actually be a really smart choice. It'd be hilarious to see, because how many riders have done that, though? I mean, what was it? It was Fogarty and Frankie Keely, right? They were never big friends, and now they're just like, you know, buddies hanging out outside the track, having a good old time. And it's kind of that, you know, after the war, the soldiers look across each other and be like, hey, wait a minute, we were doing the same thing. We were fighting somebody else's battles, and here we are. you know, we're really just the same guy on different sides of this line. So they kind of come to realize that, and they're like, oh, we have more in common than we do not. So that would definitely be an interesting pairing that might be pretty cool. Or better yet, maybe Lorenzo starts his own kind of camp, and it breeds this whole future of Lorenzo's camp versus Rossi camp. Who knows? Maybe that's the future of all these different programs coming to battle with their riders.
Any of it's possible.
Yeah. Just keep talking about it enough, it might happen. All right. So we had some listener feedback from last week that we wanted to get to this week. And don't worry, we're not going to be doing any top tens, but we did have some great points in these emails that brought up some stuff that we did want to talk about and expand upon. So we're going to start with Alan Fleming. Alan wrote us in a couple weeks ago. He had mentioned some ideas for top 10 lists, but these are some great talking points. So we're going to kind of go through these. So his first one was, and also thank you, Alan, for writing in. But his first one was the nicest or best personalities among motorcycle racers. Why don't you start, Jim?
Okay, so I'm going to put Randy Mamola out there because I just thought, you know, Mamola was like such a card, especially in the 80s for me. He was the guy that, you know, didn't win the races, but man, he looked like he was having fun doing it. So, I mean, so I'll throw that one out there.
Nice. No, Manny's definitely one of those people, you know, bubbly personality. I'd say Ben Spies for me. He may not have looked it. He was very a very even-keeled guy, but I actually got to meet him in the paddock. I've met several good handful of riders, and he was the most approachable and just was easy to have a talk to, kind of just the down-to-earth kind of guy. And I'm pretty sure that's that, you know, that bit of that southern lifestyle, being relaxed, no big hurry from Texas. But, he was a really cool dude. Just, he's kind of one of those guys you see on the track, not really that emotional either way. Doesn't really get mad, doesn't really get overexcited, just kind of is there to race.
Yeah, yeah. You know, if you want something funny, go search YouTube for the old Yamaha commercials that had Ben Spies in them.
Oh, I love those.
Like him and Colin Edwards on the Texas road trip, or when they asked Ben Spies how he figures out how to race around racetracks. Well, it looks like a T-Rex. Well, how do you race around that? I just imagine myself riding around a T-Rex. You know, the whole vacation thing was with Ben Spies and Colin Edwards is absolutely hilarious.
I mean, it's kind of a good segue into another person that you could bring up.
Yeah, well, I've got one that I don't know if this qualifies as a racing personality here, but he used to race, and that's Steve Parrish. I happen to be at Indianapolis. I happen to be walking around. I see Steve Parrish go by, and I look and I go, "Hey, Steve, I really love your work on the TT." Because at the time, Parrish was doing the color with Whittam, and I can't remember who else back then or whatever. He's like, and he stopped and he's like, "Oh yeah, you." He says, "You know, I don't have a British accent or, you know, French accent or anything like that. I have an American accent, probably more redneck than anything else." And he's like, "So you actually get it over here in the States?" It's like, "Yeah." So we wound up having a 10-minute conversation about the TT and bikes and commentating, and it was a pleasure just to talk to him. So I'm not sure if that fits the actual list of, you know, top tens or whatever of riders, but I'll take that. I'll give you that one.
No, that's definitely, I mean, he used to ride motorcycles. I mean, I think, you know, like you said, Whittam is another one. He's a great friend of the show. We haven't had a chance to talk to him a long time. That was definitely a connection that Jim had with him. He was always great in the show and always been generous at this time, but he's just a really hilarious guy. If you've ever had the chance to listen to BSB races, you'll know Whittam very well, and he's one of the best commentators you'll get to listen to in motorcycle racing. Other characters, I think it'd be hard to not be able to mention Nicky Hayden. One of the most, you know, down-to-earth motorcycle racers, especially, you know, from the United States, that when we've come across, the guy loved racing. It was hard to dislike him. I don't think I've ever heard anyone say, like, "I don't like Nicky Hayden." The guy, he was always just happy to be in front of camera. I think on his worst day, he would crack half a smile, just not a full smile. I mean, he was always just there. He gave a lot of time to fans. Even when he really didn't have to, every time we went to GP, he would come out, he was just getting mobbed at Laguna Seca to the point where it was pretty uncomfortable to even be there around the autograph scene. And Just did it with a smile on his face. Great dude.
Yeah. I'll give you, Nicky has always had that smile on his face from the first time I ever saw him, which that's a story unto itself. And since we're talking stories, I'll tell this one. So it's like 19, I want to say like 80, it's kind of fuzzy here, but I'm going to go with like about 86, 87. And here in Ohio, they would have the Grand National Dirt Track race at Lima, Ohio. So it was a half mile on a limestone track. And they that year, they were letting the amateurs race the same track just the next day. And we're all in the pits that Sunday morning, and kind of everybody's moseying around. And there's this, hey, did you hear the Haydens are here? The Haydens are here. The Haydens are here. So, you know, this kid and Tommy and Nikki, and I think at the time Jenny was racing too, they were bigger than life, even at, you know, the tender ages of like 6 and 8 and 10, right? They were everybody knew them. And so you've got this, you know, blue-grooved, slick as snot, half-mile dirt track, and it's the first practice, and they're finally getting ready to let the 80s out. And so all of a sudden somebody yells, hey, Hayden's on his 80. And I mean, everybody stopped, dropped wrenches, went and grabbed a spot along the chain link fence. And so here comes this little kid who at the time on this Kawasaki 80 couldn't touch the ground. So he had to have like a board or a box to put his foot on so that he could, you know, start. And he goes out there, and we were entering the track at like turns 1 and 2. So the first time he was at speed was coming back past us at turn 1 and 2. That kid never let off the gas, threw the bike in sideways, and had both feet on the pegs the whole way around that half mile.
Jeez.
And everybody, you know, kind of like the noise kind of goes by. And I never will forget this. This guy, I can't remember. It was just a gentleman standing around, and he stopped and he goes, my God, there's the next world champion for America. he said it was basically, I don't think it was said that way, but I think he said, wow, that kid will be world champion, as I think exactly what he said. And when that happened in 2006, I was cheering in my living room when Nikki did win the world championship. It was amazing because it was like, it had been talked about that he would do that since like 1986. It had been 20 years to get there, and he did it. So anyway, that's long crazy. Story. I'm starting to sound like Mark Miller on this podcast.
Oh, I think you've got about 20 minutes more left in you on that story before you get in that territory. But anyway,
next one.
So, yeah, we'll jump into the biggest personalities in racing. The easiest one to take is Valentino Rossi. I mean, does it really get bigger? This is someone who's beyond the sport. There's people that don't watch motorcycle racing, but they know who Valentino Rossi is, and they also know why they know him, because he's a great motorcycle racer. There are few, if I'm not sure if there are any more riders, maybe in years past, that could do that.
Kenny Roberts.
Yeah.
Kenny Roberts is a big personality. I mean, if you've, you know, the few times that, who is it? Dean Adams at Superbike Planet has had audio equipment and actually got Roberts to talk. Roberts is hilarious. Mm-hmm.
He's good.
And it's more about all the people that he's had around him who tell stories about him that are what's really funny. So I'll put that one out there.
Nice. You have any more big personalities before we jump on to the next one?
I always thought of Colin Edwards as a pretty big person.
Oh!
I mean...
That is a good one.
You know, I mean, I don't know if it's like... I don't necessarily mean it as like he was a funny person, but he had this personality about him. And it was... You could maybe almost call it just cockiness. But if you ever seen, you know, Colin back in 2002 when him and Bayless were going for the world championship in World Superbikes, and, you know, nothing was going right for Edwards that year until eventually they took one of the motor mount bolts out of the head of that RC51 at Laguna Seca, and the bike started to flex. And then he ripped off like 8 wins in a row, and it came down to a battle between him and Bayless at Imola for the championship. Mm-hmm. You know, and the way Edwards carried himself through all that, it just... He's always been sort of brash and outspoken, very American, very much. It's, you know, he's proud of being an American, doesn't have any shame about it. And he just had a different kind of attitude, swagger, whatever you want to call. But it was pretty much larger than life, that's for sure.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So Alan brings us the opposite. The best jerks. That's a great way of putting it. Not jerks of motorcycle racing, but the best jerks of motorcycle racing. He mentioned a couple here that do come to mind. Matt Mladen here for sure was known as definitely having an abrasive personality here on the track. He was all business. He was here to win races. He was about playing mind games. And it worked. I mean, you can't say, why would you do that? He did that and rattled off like 7 championships in a row. So, I mean, if it works, it works, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I've got one, but no way would know who it was except for me. But it was a kid. His name was Terry Eike. And we raced against him when I was on 80. So this is like eons ago. But it was like you go to start at the starting line, and he would pull his bike up and literally have it pointed at a 45-degree angle so that he could get to the first turn first. I can't count the number of times that him and I would lock handlebars and fall down at the start of a race. But, ugh. So I'll put that one there, but that's sort of from a different category. But I do like Alan's choice of John Kaczynski. That's, yeah, that one probably is the best choice.
Yeah, there's definitely others on the list there. Casey Stoner and Carl Fogarty. Definitely Keen Carl was much like, he was like the British Matt Mladen, kind of reeled off a bunch of championships and didn't care who was in his way. Casey was more of a, like, you know, he had this personality of me against the world, and I think that, you know, that allowed him to carry a chip on his shoulder all the way through his racing career. And, you know, just that's what some of these guys thrive off of. They have to have that attitude to be successful. I'm the best, but I'm going to prove it to you every single weekend. And, you know, there's a common theme of, you know, Aussies kind of being this way, but that's an Aussie grit. You know, I've had the pleasure of learning how to hang with Aussies, and the first thing is they're going to give you a bunch of shit. They're going to just rip on you constantly, and it's kind of a test. If you get in there and start mixing it up and having fun, then all of a sudden they're just the coolest people ever. But if you start taking offense to it, it's like the blood is in the water. They're gonna come get you, and they're not gonna leave you alone. And I mean, I love it. That's my kind of jam. But I definitely see where people can get, you know, really put aside by the abrasive personality that some of the Australians, especially the ones on this list, will have.
I agree. I mean, it's tough Aussie grit, right? I mean, that's just the way they are. It's the way they're built.
All right, so now, finally, he brings us the best supporters of racing as an ex-racer. And this is actually a really cool kind of topic because it's something that we think is almost like a new phenomenon, but it's been around for a little while. And some racers have made your strides, but the first one on his list here is Kenny Robertson, the Ranch. And the Ranch has been around for quite some time. It's had quite a few riders go through. And that's a big deal for a rider to, when they do quit, is to go ahead and put their own effort into riding. And it's kind of one of those wonderful things of riders giving back to the community that they love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but Roberts also had his Team KR.
And, oh, good point.
You know, so he had that part of it as well. I mean, sadly, the Ranch has been sold, and so it is no longer.
True.
So, but, I mean, that doesn't matter. It's still, he put a lot of time and effort into it. You know, Alan mentions Wayne Rainey because he's got Moto America and whatnot. Good choice there. I like that one. One that is in from a different category was Carl Fogarty because he started a Petronas Fogarty World Superbike effort, right?
Oh my God, I forgot about that.
Yeah. So that's one that I thought of that wasn't mentioned by Alan. I mean, you know, Carl Fogarty sort of like got the best of the jerks, right? And then he kind of turned it around and became a, you know, big supporter of racing. But him and Whitman did their tour, right? And they would go to, you know, bars or pubs or whatever. But that was for charity. That was like for a Riders for Health thing or something, wasn't it? So yeah, there's Mamola. You could throw Mamola into best supporters because he's been a massive advocate of Riders for Health. So it's not necessarily supporting racing, but it's using racing to support the greater good, right? So
And as mentioned, you know, Rossi, he's got his whole boot camp going. I mean, not boot camp, but his version of the Ranch essentially, and then he has his own race teams. He has like the old VR46 Academy. It's a huge thing where he brings them in, not only how to ride a motorcycle really fast, how to get better, but the training that goes along with it, the media. speaking English, like all of these things that they put into it, how to become the best all-around writer and like MotoGP spokesman. That's a pretty major thing. We've seen the Texas Tornado Boot Camp. So Colin Edwards, that seemed like something he started as fun and caught so much traction he couldn't help himself, and he just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and he just seems to have a whole lot of fun with that. I've never had the opportunity to go on, but man, I sure would love to.
Yeah, I'll throw one more at you, Nick Einoch, because he has his ghost camp where he teaches little kids or people who are essentially it's kids, okay, but kids that like have never ridden before go there. Kids who can barely ride go there. But what's cool about what Nick does is he teaches you how to ride, but he also teaches you how to work on your bike.
Nice.
So I like that. So I'll throw that one in. That's very all I cool. got. That's all I came up with.
So there's a few more Alan mentioned. There was Milky Quail. He was an Isle of Man new rider coach. Steve McLaughlin started the World Superbike Series. And David Tardozzi, who's now the Ducati team manager, among other accolades he's had as running different teams. So thank you very much, Alan. Those are some great talking points. I hope everybody enjoyed those. And we're going to jump over to another email here. This is from JB. And he says, nice top 10 riders list in the most recent episode. Of course, this was a couple back that he's referring to. Since there's no racing going on, how about some street bike talk? All right, JB. Definitely. Now, he had mentioned doing a top 10 list, and me and Jim were like, we can't do another top 10. Everyone's so sick of that. But the street bike aspect was cool. So we're going to put a little twist on it and say maybe like the important street bikes or the ones that we've really had a connection to. And then there's those street bikes that everybody is kind of lusted after. And maybe some of those that have been like the iconic ones. So we'll kind of just ramble on about it here. I have nowhere to go. Jim has told me many times before we started this show that he has nowhere to go. So we're just going to do this until we get sick of doing this, I think.
Sounds like a plan. So, you want me to start it off? Okay, go ahead. Go ahead. You start.
I'll roll Rochambeau if you want. We could do this right now. Who wants to go first?
For those of you listening in, this is not a video podcast, so I can't see him doing rock, paper, scissors. Although, knowing you, you would probably go paper, so I'd have to go scissors.
All right. Well, there you go. So Jim's going to lead it off.
Okay, so the first bike, and this it's like, you know, again, this isn't like a top 10 list or anything. This is just things that conjure up memories and whatnot in us. So I'm going with a Suzuki GT380 3-cylinder 2-stroke street bike, and the reason for it is my father had two of them, and it is like the one of the first motorcycles I can remember riding on, because my dad would take the bike, and he would ride up to town to get something for mom, and he would grab me, he would put me on the gas tank, and I'd hold on to the handlebars, and I would be in front of him, and I was so small, like really I only had a few words, but I knew faster, and that's really the only word you need to know when you're on a motorcycle. So I'll start there with a GT380.
For me, it's probably the bike that really grabbed my attention the first time. I remember it specifically. I was on a road trip with my dad and my mom, and we were going nowhere far, just kind of around our area here, but out in the back roads. And there was a group of motorcycles went past us, but it was all Ducatis. And I remember they kind of got next to us to slow down, and I could look over out of my window, and I read 916 on the side of the bike. And I was like, what is that? My dad said, oh, those are expensive Italian bikes. They're like as much as the car we're sitting in. I was like, wait, what? And I was like, that's insane. Motorcycles cost that much? Well, not all, but even back in the day, you know, Ducatis were definitely expensive. And the 916 to me was just that perfect looking bike. It's probably more so of a personal connection is why it looks so good to me, but just the lines, the sound, and the actual like heritage of that bike, I love the 916.
Yeah, we happen to agree, because the 916 was in my list as well. Only it's a very different story. I remember getting the Cycle World that the 916 was on the cover on. And I was probably, gosh, what year was the 916, Skylar? Like 90? Is the first one like a 90 or 91?
I was basically old enough to remember small parts of my life, but too young to really hold on to anything else around it.
So basically, I think I was probably 16 at the time when it came out then, or I was close to 16. And I remember looking at that cover, and I remember looking at that bike, and I was like, oh my God, that is sex on two wheels.
Mm-hmm.
It was so stunning. It was so different. It was so elegant. It was so, you know, everything was pristine. It was the absolute most vibrant red. It didn't have like the bronzy, goldish colored wheels that were on it, right? And It was just so different than any conventional motorcycle that you had seen at the time. And it was just so, you know, I don't care. You can roll a 916 onto a showroom floor today, and it will still grab more attention than any other street bike that's in the dealership. It's just that amazing of a motorcycle, just from its pure looks. Not to mention that it had a racing pedigree and won, you know, World Superbike titles and on and on and on and on, right? So it actually has a legacy that's probably one of the greatest legacies of any one motorcycle that had been built, you know? So there's that one.
Yeah, no, definitely love that. Another bike that's another thumper that I really loved, because at the time when I was getting into racing, this was a special bike that was pretty much a homologation special, and that's the Honda RC51. And I mean, we could probably name most of the RC bikes, the RC30, the 51, but for me, the RC51 was so cool, because whenever you thought about Honda street bikes, you thought about four cylinders and screaming, and here comes this thumper that sounded very similar to a Ducati, because that's who they were going to battle with, because they can get the extra CCs at the time. It was and the paint scheme was wild, just that silver and red, which is different than anything else that Honda was doing at the time. And the street bike scene was all starting to get to the point where everyone was just kind of doing the same thing across the board, and that broke the mold in the Japanese street bikes, and it was really cool to see.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I like that choice. I do. I've got a little different spin this one. I don't know if you know of this one. It's an older one. A Yamaha V-Max.
V-Max. All right.
So it was like the muscle car bike of the time. It was a cruiser bike. It wasn't a repl racer. It was just a V4 Yamaha that just had just absolutely insane horsepower in it for the time, right? I mean, it probably only maybe had 180 horsepower, but at the time, you know, in the early 80s, that was pretty far out for a street bike. And it had. I'll never forget the commercials and the ads. It had a thing called V-Boost, where you had the two carburetors were in between the V, and when you got on the throttle, like over half throttle, it would open this, the cable would open up a butterfly, and so both carburetors fed all the cylinders together, gave it V-Boost. I remember Eddie Lawson being on that bike after having won, I think, the 88 world title, and just doing some crazy ass burnouts in promotional work for Yamaha for being world champion. So yeah, that's just memories, memories, memories. You have to look that one up. Google it, people. It's worth a look.
One of the most important street bikes, I think, this doesn't go down for, it's not going to win anything in the looks category or power, but definitely around here. And we're seeing that its lineage has now started a whole new scene, and that's the Kawasaki Ninja 250. Now, they were the only bike that was a street bike that was in small capacity before everybody started doing one now. And that was where so many people have started. There was, you know, how many Ninja 250 were there club racing? You know, there was a ton in that class because they were affordable. If you drop them, no big deal. They're almost like motocross bikes. You just get out there and you just bend it back the other way and you keep going. They're tough, reliable. You find parts everywhere for them. And having a bike like that available for the people, I mean, you can take those bikes up and still have a lot of fun with them. One of the funniest stories is when I first met my sister-in-law, who was just at the time my girlfriend's sister, she had her Ninja 250, and then she had just bought a Ducati Monster, and then her boyfriend at the time had an R6, and they said, hey, you want to go riding with us sometime, you can use the 250. And I was like, yeah, that's no big deal, because I had my CBR, but it was down from one of the half dozen crashes that I had on it, but we won't go into that.
That was the last week's episode. Up there.
Exactly. And she said, yeah, you know, the Ninja's not really my thing. I've kind of outgrown it. And I was like, oh, really? You've outgrown the Ninja? Okay, cool. And then I just went up there, took him up the hills, and just like, yeah, I don't have to really get off the gas on this thing. I'm just going to hold it through the corners. And I was like dragging the foot pegs up there. And I was like, oh, this thing's a little sketchy, but it was still just a blast to have something that you didn't have to worry about the power. And you could just worry about your lines and ride. And I was like, oh, man, that was one of the funnest times I've ever had. And I think a lot of people have had that very similar story on that bike.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay. So I'm gonna go with Honda's RC30. That is, to me, my dream bike. Like, that's the one that I want. I want that one in the garage.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's, and I want the one that's red, white, and blue, which was the 1990 version of it. And
I'm right there with you.
That's the only colors I want. And a part of it for me, for wanting the bike is I thought it was really super cool that it had it did a lot of the those of us who followed Grand Prix racing in the 80s, there was Ron Haslam rode the Elf bike, right? It was this bike that had a single-sided rear swing arm. It had this weird telescoping fork front end on it that didn't have forks, and it was crazy. It was like, oh wow, here's a street bike that has this really wild GP technology, i.e. this single-sided swing arm on it. It was the V4, which makes a very unique sound, and it just looked pretty. And you know, it helped that Fred Merkel won the first two World Superbike titles on a roomy RC30. So that just sort of cemented it in my book. And I mean, if you look, and I've been looking for one, a decent one with a, you know, fair amount of miles, it will still cost you $10,000 to this mm-hmm. day. So it's rather interesting, but I've always loved that bike. Just me.
Yep. I'll keep in mind a very important race bike, especially for club racing, that is still to this day and now is pretty much the go-to for centers, and that's the Yamaha R6. And Yamaha, it seems like, especially now, because we've kind of going away from the 600s, like that was the pinnacle. Like that's as good as they get, because they've had that same frame and setup since about 2006, I think. Just about small probably, tweaks yeah. here and there. But that's how good of a package that bike was. And if you didn't have an R6, you weren't winning races. You could see this even all the way up to the World Supersport level. That was the bike to be on, and the other teams would challenge. You know, the Honda would challenge for a few races. Envy Agusta might challenge Kawasaki, especially when they bought the new one here a little bit in later years. But I mean, if you really want to see that R6 at its best, I have to say when Cal Crutchlow was riding World Supersport on the R6, and he was just wringing that thing's neck, and there was races he would go out there and just mollywop the field. The entire field, nobody could hang with him, and that bike was just razor sharp, and still is. But I the way the 600s are going, that might be a dying breed, but definitely an important bike for racing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I'll go with another important bike for racing. It kind of defined a genre, the 1985 Suzuki GSX-R
750. Oh yeah,
the oil cooled. Air oil cooled Repla racer, the cafe racer, the bike that sort of started the whole, you know, before this, bikes were basically naked for all intents and purposes. And then this bike had fairings on it, and it was square and boxy looking, and it was really bizarre, especially the seat section. But mm-hmm. I remember Doug Poland winning all of these Suzuki Cup races and making all this contingency money, but on this GSXR, and he got to the, I think it was the Weir Grand National Finals down at Road Atlanta, and he blew everybody away on this GSXR, and everybody said, well, there's no way that bike was legal to the rules. So they wind up tearing down Poland's bike and found out that not only was it indeed stock, It was also badly in need of a tune-up and a set of rings, and he still beat everybody with it. So it's kind of a momentous sort of a moment in history that I won't forget.
Oh, man. There's so many good bikes. You know, those are ones that have come to my mind, especially that just right off the top of my head. It's like, you know, those are the bikes when someone mentions them I think of right away.
I've got one more.
Sure.
This one to me is the pinnacle of engineering. Honda NR750.
Are we talking oval pistons here?
The oval piston 32 valve, four spark plug, 36 millimeter stroke,
way ahead of its time. 1000
RPM motorcycle that when yes. they finally did build one, two things were totally cool about that bike. One, on the rear wheel, because it had a single-sided swing arm, on the rear wheel, they engraved a decade's worth of dedication on the wheel because it took them over a decade to make it work, okay? And two, there was a run on oval pistons at the Honda bike shops because everybody wanted an oval piston. Everybody. It didn't matter. You wanted it to put your pins in on your desk. You wanted it for an ashtray. It didn't matter. Everybody wanted an oval piston because nobody had ever seen anything like it before. And the story behind the bike is what really makes it, right? You know, believe it or not, Honda has hated two-strokes, always has, always will. They love four-strokes. So they figured, hey, if we're limited to the same cc size as a two-stroke, well, then that means we got to have a four-stroke that revs twice as high. Simple math, simple logic, right? So they started going down that path of thinking, you know, well, how many RPM are we going to have? Well, okay, you know, most two-strokes of the day were at that 9,500 to 10,000 RPM, which means you had to get to 20,000 RPM with a four stroke. And then they went from there and figured out that, you know, hey, if we do this, there's only so much force you can have as far as your speed of acceleration and decel before the piston will start to fragment in the engine. So they figured out the stroke could only be 36 millimeters. Well, to get to 500 cc's with a 36 millimeter stroke, you had to have this piston that was like four times the diameter of like anything else they'd ever done. And they're like, well, the wrist pin in it is so long, it's going to be unstable and it's going to wobble back and forth in the bore. We can't do that. So some genius decides, well, what if we put two connecting rods on it? And wait a minute, who said that they had the pistons to be round? So they literally took essentially a V8 engine and shoved it together. They shoved two sets of cylinders together in a V8. I mean, if you Google it, if you ever have pictures of it, if you just look at the engineering in the valve train, the valves, the spark plugs, I mean, it was just this crazy far out engineering concept that Honda put out there. And, you know, everybody knew that that bike was special because it cost like friggin', I think it was like 75 or 80 grand back in, so I want to say like the middle part of the 90s, somewhere around there.
So we're talking $130,000 bike now.
Oh, easily. But the cool part is there were people who were smart enough who never took them out of the shipping crates. And occasionally, every now and then, like one pops up like once every 10 years. So we're probably due for another one. It's going to be some dealer who was in. I remember the last one that popped up was a dealer that was in Holland. He had an NR750 that was still in the shipping crate from Honda, and his asking price was $200,000 US, and I'm pretty sure he got it.
Oh yeah, no doubt everybody
wants that thing, but I'll never get one because I do not have that kind of money to spend on a motorcycle. But yeah, I mean, it may not be the prettiest looking motorcycle. I mean, that kind of goes to the Ducati and the 916, but as far as engineering and mechanics and whatnot, that wins hands down.
Nothing's and it sounds really cool too.
Yes, it sounds like it's about ready to kill something. get out of its way.
Yeah, I got to see one of those at a bike show one year, and they fired up when I was coming there, and I was just listening to like, oh my god, this bike. If you had this sound now, everybody would go and buy this bike. It wouldn't even be close. But I think that's a great bike to kind of
end on.
Cap this discussion off of. Yeah, because it really just hardly doesn't get better until you start getting into some weird prototype stuff. But
well, the only thing that might be better might be John Britton's Britton.
Oh, yeah. That's just a work of art, though. I mean, do you even ride that, or you just put that in your living room and stare at it every day? I mean,
I'd put it in my living room and stare at it every day.
Yeah, I think that's what I'd be doing, too. So, awesome. Well, Alan, thanks again. JB, thanks. definitely great topics to the show. Remember, folks, if you want to write into the show, you can as well. That's motopod@motopodcast.com. Or what you can do, just like we had, Douglas wrote in here, and he actually sent us a audio file, which we're going to play on the next show, because I'm trying to figure out how to do live audio while we're recording so we can react. So it's definitely a limitation in technology until I figure that out. But Douglas, thank you for sending it in. He's got a great story. If you have stories that you want to share and you don't feel like typing them up, but you want to do a small recording, go ahead and send us the recording. Just try to keep it, under 10 minutes. We'll put it on the show, have everybody listen to it if you're okay with that. And we'll just kind of review and talk about that. We've got plenty of time. We're here until July, folks. So make sure you get us in. Once again, that's motopod@motopodcast.com. That will go to all of the hosts. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram. I am at SkylarV28. Jim, where can people find you?
MotoRGV at Instagram and Twitter.
Perfect. And we're also, the show is also on Twitter, and that can be found at @moto_pod. You can follow us there for any news, our Facebook fan page. You can find us at facebook.com/motopod. I really do need to get better at updating that. It always slips my mind when I get these shows out because I've been having fun doing the editing and so on and so forth. Well, Jim, it's going to be amazing, but we've managed to hit just under an hour like we say we're always going to do every single week.
Woo!
Yay! So, not bad. One out of every 30. Right on.
That's all good. Hey, Marion. Yeah, no. Hey, listen, people. Marion. This is just two guys rapping about motorcycles, and when you put us together like this, this is just what's going to happen. We're just going to talk, and that's just... Yep. Hopefully you enjoy it. Hopefully it breaks up the monotony of quarantine. Hopefully things will start to reopen here in the U.S., and I hope that, racing and sports are going to come back here shortly. So, fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. All right, everybody. Until next time. Zoom, zoom.